Greetings. This is Steve Schlissel. I'm the pastor of Messiah's Congregation in Brooklyn, New York, and I have the privilege on the Voice of Chalcedon to speak with R.J. Rushdoony, who is the founder and president of the Chalcedon Foundation in Vallecito, California. I'll tell you now, I'll try to tell you again before the end of this broadcast, how you can write to Chalcedon, which is spelled C-H-A-L-C-E-D-O-N. You can write to them at Box 158 at Vallecito, California, 95251. And when you write, send $2 and ask for a copy of the Chalcedon Report, and you will find a perspective on the breadth of biblical knowledge and application that perhaps you've never seen before. It's a wonderful magazine that comes out monthly, and $2 will get you a sample copy from which you can decide if you want to continue to subscribe to it. Today, Rush and I will continue our conversation that we've been having concerning beginning things and final things. And we had been speaking about millennial positions, particularly post-millennialism. But Rush, within Reformed camps and within evangelical camps, there are three basic positions that are generally accepted as within orthodoxy. What are those?
They are premillennialism, amillennialism, and postmillennialism. And all have deep roots in church history.
This is an odd way to ask the question, perhaps, but are there cycles of acceptance concerning these various positions? Do we go through cycles where amillennialism seems to have an ascendant position and then post-mill?
There seems to be an indication of that. Clearly, for example, for some time in the early church, premillennialism predominated. It again came to the fore later in the early modern era, and again in the century now ending. It became particularly powerful in this century. In the 20s into the 50s, it has waned somewhat since then.
Probably, in no small part, due to your writings. Well, let's assume no knowledge of millenarianism on our listeners' parts and go over this somewhat basically. The idea of millennium comes from the word for 1,000 years. And when we talk about pre-millennialism, what are we referring to?
That before the millennium, certain things are going to take place. So that pre means before, post after, and neither.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said that pre-mill, we'll say the pre-mill position, shorthand for premillennialism, which is a mouthful, this position had some wide acceptance in the early church. But the version of it that was widely accepted then and occasionally throughout church history is quite a bit different from the dispensational approach, which has been for the last 150 years or so quite popular in America.
The dispensational approach is a very modern version of a premillennialism, so that to a degree there's almost no resemblance between the early church premillennialism and that of our century.
Let's take one example. In the idea that the church is the heir of the promises and blessings to Israel, as well as the threats and curses, this was widespread among pre-mill believers in the early church and on throughout church history. But dispensationalists tend to make a very radical distinction between Israel and Old Testament and the church and New Testament. Is that correct?
Yes. In fact, that has been perhaps the major change in eschatology in all of church history, because there is no relationship between the early church's premillennialism and that of this century.
It really should be called perhaps by another name, because there is a position that is called George Ladd, for example, wasn't it, who had historic premillennialism?
Yes. The early church held to that very strongly. It was inclined to that for a number of reasons. First, the idea had some a circulation in Jewish circles.
Mm-hmm.
Then, second, the Greco-Roman world was beginning to foresee its end, and they could not imagine the world continuing if Rome ended. We have that opinion to a degree in our time, in that people find it hard to believe that God will continue history in any fashion after our time.
Isn't that amazing how deep set that conviction is, that America equals the world?
Yes. It has too commonly affected other millennial perspectives as well, so that they've come to believe that somehow we are the end. What else could God want to bring forth in history?
It's amazing. As if God couldn't tomorrow judge us, in fact even eliminate us, and raise up a gospel witness in China that would
exactly
ensure a marvelous future for the earth and God's kingdom.
Well, when I hear of the work in Africa and the development of the church there, I wonder if sometimes if the future of Christianity is not in Africa.
Well, we've seen an example in our own time, Rush. Remember that Korea was bathed in complete darkness in the last century, and now Koreans are sending out missionaries to Western Europe.
That's right. And there are black pastors in Britain who are the major factor for orthodoxy, who believe, really believe, the Bible.
That's wonderful testimony to what God
yes.
is doing and what God can do. Now, do the millennial positions, how are they informed by one's theology? Let me give you a little background to the question I'm asking. In the middle of the 19th century, some people would say as late as, or others would say as recently as, it was commonly written that among those who would call themselves faithful heirs of the Reformation, you could not deny the postmillennial expectation and retain your Christian character or reputation.
Mm-hmm.
That so strongly embedded in the thinking of
yes.
Western Christianity was the postmillennial vision that it was equated with the Christian eschatology.
Yes.
That certainly went through a decline after the middle of the 19th century, though.
Yes, very dramatically, too.
Was it an influence of theology? Was there something else happening that influenced people's eschatology?
It was a number of things. First of all, as the Reformed faith began to decline as a result of the concerted attack of humanists who saw it as the central enemy, men more and more began to see, as history saw the development of technology, that certainly the end was coming. We were reaching a height that was going to be unreachable after that. So they began to see the end. Also, as they saw the drift towards international chaos. Remember, the two world wars of our century had not occurred in previous centuries, say from the Reformation to the present.
Yes.
And the thinking which accompanied them was one of fearfulness. God certainly was bringing history to an end with such dramatic and chaotic activities predominating. And so the expectation of the end intensified in this century because of the two world wars. It began to fade when the dating for the millennium collapsed by about 1972.
Now, this idea of dating, in a survey of the field we have, you have premillennialism looks for an intervention in history prior to the consummation and certain things that will happen after, as they call it, the return of Christ to earth. Postmillennialism looks for God's activity to prosper in history prior to the consummation. For the amillennial position, which is not strictly correct, it's not as if they don't believe in any idea of millennium, as per Revelation 20, but they don't hold to it as either of the other camps do.
Yes.
So their vision is more or less status quo, isn't it?
That's right. They actually see perhaps the world is going downhill. Since they do not believe in Christ's victory in history, they've got to see something else triumphing, and they see humanistic man triumphing, the church saving souls, snatching them out of the growing disaster, and it's basically a rather sad and grim outlook. Not widespreadly held. Now, some churches do hold the amillennial position, but it lacks the enthusiasm that either premillennial or postmillennial thinking has. It's impossible to get very enthusiastic about an eschatology that says you're a loser.
It was what good old J. Vernon McGee once said, right? You don't polish brass on a sinking ship.
Yes.
Well, then it would seem that both pre and ah would hold this in common, that the implications of the entire Bible in terms of application to culture, to family, to church, and other institutions is severely limited by their eschatology.
Yes. Postmillennialism rather expands it. It looks forward to victory within history with an assumption of all rule in all fields by Christians. So it's a very, very vigorously optimistic eschatology.
Does postmillennialism require a vision with each and every person on earth regenerated and converted?
Some hold to that, but not necessarily so. Certainly, it holds to an expectation that Christians will be the triumphant people.
You've noted in many places that, in fact, it's rarely a majority of people that have their will, quote-unquote, imposed on a culture.
Yes, it does not believe in imposition, of course. Postmillennialism believes that by conversion, step by step, we are going to take over the world. All the peoples, all the disciplines, every area of life and thought will be Christianized. And this will be done peaceably. By conversion.
That couldn't help but have a huge impact on one's personal life.
Very, very definitely so. Holding that perspective, you're certainly going to be hopeful about things.
In our day, people would say How could you have a post-millennial expectation if you read the newspapers and if you read them intelligently, if you understand the depth of the penetration of humanism in the institutions, if you see the corruption of the federal, state, and local governments, if you see the egalitarianism that has become the de facto ethic of the entire civilization of the West, so that there seems to be even no room for Christianity, how can someone have a positive future orientation in the face of what we see today?
Yes, I've heard that often. And the answer to that is we don't get our eschatology from the newspapers. We get it from the Word of God, from the Bible. And it is a sad fact that too many, including Hal Lindsey, have dismissed postmillennialism from the newspapers. And that's a rather laughable bit of exegesis.
Yes. Well, Mr. Lindsey and some of his followers would suggest that your position as a Christian Reconstructionist is inherently anti-Semitic.
Well, that's ridiculous. Of course, they have suggested it. But the simple fact is that the post-millennial position is more in conformity with Old Testament eschatology than any other.
Perhaps it's due to that thing we mentioned before, Rush, of this, in the dispensational view, the absolute necessity of making a separation between the Church and Israel, and therefore Old and New Testament.
Yes, and one could call that anti-Semitic, although, of course, that isn't the main motive in it.
Yes. This idea of a post-millennial vision being anti-Semitic is really laughable when you recognize that historically, just for example, the Jews had been banished from England, just one instance, and from 1290 to 1650 or 60 or so, when Cromwell admitted them back in based upon his conversion to a post-millennial eschatology.
That's right.
So for hundreds of years under another eschatology, the Jews were excluded. As soon as the Puritans began to realize that God's dealings with them were not complete and that they formed a part of the program for God's progress of the gospel through the world, the whole attitude of Europe changed toward Jewry, didn't it?
Yes, and most Puritans were post-millennial. Now, Cotton Mather switched to a pre-mill position and did a great deal of harm to the development and future of Puritanism in this country. Jonathan Edwards reverted back to the older post-millennialism, and at least one historian, Bushman, has said that it was the post-millennialism that was propagated by Jonathan Edwards and his followers that led to the War of Independence, because suddenly Christians became very hopeful. They believed in conquest. They felt that the whole of the continent should be given over to Christ, and that they had a duty to resist those who were anti-Christian. We forget something, and our history books now omit it, that the British Army during the War of Independence was largely a mercenary army, not made of volunteers, not even made entirely of Englishmen. They were hired mercenaries, many of them Hessians from Germany. These were people who volunteered to make money. One of the most common acts when a British force moved into an area during the war was that the churches were burned, the hymnals and the Bibles were burned. And so in many areas of the colonies, for the first generation after the War of Independence ended, a major problem for Christianity was to rebuild churches.
Mm. They recognized that this was, as some of them once called it, a Presbyterian revolt.
Yes, that's what some agents of Britain called it. And the fact that Britain at that time was very indifferent to Christianity. Wesley and Whitfield had begun their work, but they were held in contempt, and there was a considerable amount of opposition to them. They succeeded best here in the colonies.
They had fabulous audiences here
yes.
in the States.
But the hostility was so marked that the British commanders had absolutely no opposition to give to the destruction of churches and of Bibles. One of the things we need to recognize, too, is that the British command during the War of Independence was made up of gentlemen who were part of the Enlightenment and very indifferent, if not hostile, to Christianity. As a result, they had a great deal of contempt for the colonial religious life. We see in our history books a curious example of that. One of the very much lauded men is Major Andre,
mm-hmm.
the British spy who was sentenced to death and who paid the price, and Washington refused to intervene in his execution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our history books to this day treat a relatively minor figure as important and have a great deal to say about him. But on the other hand, less and less men like Nathan Hale, American spies, who were at the same time militant Bible believers.
Mm-hmm.
They are disappearing from American history.
Well,
Major Andre is as important as ever.
It would then be behooving to listeners to pick up source material to learn about the origins of this nation, if, in keeping with the theme of this particular show, if for nothing else to see how a post-millennial expectation radically affected the spirit and the fighting power of the colonies against English tyranny.
Yes. Jonathan Edwards was, according to a non-Christian historian, Bushman, more responsible for the War of Independence than any other single man, precisely because of his post-millennial perspective.
Well, I want to tell the listeners that this issue, then, is one with implications. It's one that would lead people to be willing to fight for freedom rather than to submit to the yoke of tyranny, and also to have an expectation of victory on the other side, even if they should die, because there's something worth fighting for the glory of God and for the ushering in of his kingdom. What a wonderful idea, a grace that God would use us in the extension of his kingdom.
In reading accounts of the period by Americans, one of the things that is commonplace is that when the British were beginning to move into an area, all the women and children moved out because rape was routine. Remember what I said, these soldiers that Britain sent over were foreign mercenaries or domestic mercenaries, men without faith by and large. One of the interesting little side stories of the War of Independence is that in spite of the war, Americans were able to convert a number of these people so that these soldiers, when the war was over, insisted on remaining in the colonies.
Well, I have to interrupt at this point because that's a fine story for a post-millennial talk show about the conversion of the enemies through the witness of the soldiers, but our time has run out. I just want to encourage the listeners to call 209-736-4365 to find out more about Chalcedon, and to tune in next time as we continue our discussions about history and about the Bible and how it applies to all of life with R.J. Rushdoony. The Lord bless you all, and good evening.